morning, night?
I do work long hours, but I'm also on different shifts. Today I work the night shift.
How's business?
Slow now. We sell a lot in the morning when people are going to work. Coffee, cigarettes, and sausage biscuits, and Red Bull by the gallon.
The other person here when I came by the first time. Billy, right? Is he here? She shook her head.
No, he's not here.
He doesn't work here anymore, does he? Decker said. She looked startled.
How did you know that?
When was he here last?
The day you came in the first time. I was pissed when he didn't show up for work after that. I had to do his job, too.
Do you have his employment file here?
Yes, in the back.
Can I see it?
No, company policy.
Can you tell me his last name?
Why?
He might be the one I was looking for.
I don't see how.
Decker held up his phone. I can have the FBI here in 5 minutes, and they'll take every file in this place. He eyed the woman steadily. Are you an American citizen? She blanched.
No, but I have papers.
I'm sure they're in perfect order. At least I hope they are. The FBI will check, of course. They check everything. Twice. The woman slowly put a pack of cigarettes in the appropriate slot and made a check on her inventory sheet. He could tell she was stalling as she thought about how to respond to this.
My work visa might be a little overdue.
That's unfortunate. With the government in gridlock over immigration reform, it's a touchy subject. I'm sure you can appreciate that.
And if I let you see Billy's file?
Decker put his phone away. That might change things. The woman went into the back office and came out a minute later with the file.
You can have this. I made a copy.
Decker went to the door, locked it, and turned the open sign to closed.
What are you doing?
Decker pulled out his phone again. The FBI will be here in a few minutes. I'm afraid this store will be closed for quite a while.
But I gave you the file.
And I thank you for that. But one has nothing to do with the other.
But what will the FBI do here?
They'll be looking for any trace of Billy, and don't worry. They won't care about your immigration status.
But why is Billy so important? He just mops floors.
He's important principally because he's not Billy. His name is Belinda. Hours later, Bogart walked out of the 7-Eleven and over to Decker, who was standing in the parking lot sipping 7-Eleven coffee while the snow slowly swirled around him. Bogart said, "We got one usable print, 7 points on a mop bucket in the storage room. We ran it, but got no hits back yet. It may be Wyatt's or whoever else handled that bucket, and she might not be on any database. Or I guess she's a he now, this Billy guy. But she was gang-raped in Utah, according to Dr. Marshall. They must have a police file on her." "You would think, but we checked with the police department where she grew up. They have no record of any rape of Belinda Wyatt." Decker looked stunned. "But they can't be. She was raped and beaten and left for dead. It changed her brain. That's why she was sent to the Institute. You heard Dr. Marshall. And he said he'd talked to the doctor from Utah. She had been raped and beaten and left for dead." "Well, maybe she was. But maybe she didn't file a police report, Decker. That's a possibility." "But why wouldn't she? Consider her personal situation. It being a small town, where everybody knows everybody else's business, she might have made the decision not to report. Or her parents made that decision for her," retorted Decker. "That's actually far more likely," conceded the FBI agent. Decker finished his coffee and threw the cup into a trash can. Belinda was very tall for a woman, about 5'11", and skinny. Billy was that height, and lean, too. But he was wiry, maybe 150 pounds.
"And definitely a guy?"
"I think so, but he looked androgynous, too. Belinda looked the same at the Institute. I've already given your sketch artist a description. They're working on a finished drawing now.
We can get that all over the place once it's done.
I would just get it out to law enforcement for now. Don't go public. They may go underground if they discover we've gotten that far.
Bogart didn't look convinced, but said,
Okay, we'll play it that way. For now.
He put his hands in his pockets and studied the pavement.
We heard back from the pool service company, the Wyatts used in Colorado. They came and winterized the pool 2 months ago but didn't see anyone. Their fees are on an automatic pay system. In fact, all their bills were on auto pay. They didn't have to interact with anyone. Dead end. No pun intended.
And Leopold?
Bogart let out an extended breath.
Leopold, yes. I was getting to him. We finally got a hit.
His real name?
Surprisingly enough, Sebastian Leopold. You were right. He's Austrian.
And his story?
Still coming in. But the gist is his wife and daughter were murdered, and the killer was never brought to justice.
When did he come over here?
Hard to pin that down. The murder was 8 years ago. So any time after that, I guess. I doubt he's here legally. But then again, I don't think we're as picky with Europeans as we are with other folks.
If he's only been here a few years, he's worn his accent away relatively fast. He only had the one slip when I was talking with him. Can I see anything you have on him?
I'll arrange it. Where will you be?
Back at the library at Mansfield.
You want to ride over there?
I need to make one stop first.
Where?
To pick up my partner.
Your partner? You don't mean Lancaster. After what almost happened to her family, I don't think she's up to it.
Mary is up to it.
How do you know that?
Because I know Lancaster. She's tougher than you and me combined.
Chapter 56. Lancaster and Jameson were sitting across from Decker in the school library. They were awaiting Leopold's files. Decker had filled Lancaster in on everything they had learned. He said, Bogart thinks that Belinda might not have filed a police report. He believes her parents might have discouraged her from doing so.
Talk about scum,
replied Lancaster fiercely.
The thing is, her trauma left her with perfect recall. She would have remembered her attackers.
If she knew them in the first place,
said Jameson.
Decker replied, Small town Utah. Everybody probably knew everybody.
At the Institute, did she ever talk?
Asked Lancaster.
Almost never. In the group session, she never talked about what had happened to her. I didn't know until Dr. Marshall told me. And she was probably attacked because her assailants knew of her intersex condition, added Decker.
Lancaster shook her head.
I never heard the term until you told me. I can't imagine what that must have been like. You said Marshall told you she had one testis and one ovary?
Yes.
The absolute shit she must have taken in school. In gym class, one of the other girls spots her private parts, word spreads. It really must have been horrible.
Decker was staring down at the document in front of him. He had just seen one fact that did not align with another. Lancaster was well used to this look.
What?
He glanced at her.
Dr. Marshall said the address he had in the file for Belinda's parents was 15 years old, but she was at the Institute 20 years ago.
Well, maybe they kept in touch for some reason. I doubt Belinda stayed there for 5 years. It must be a more recent address.
But Marshall also said that the Wyatts never visited her at the Institute. So why would he have had the later address in the first place? Were they corresponding? He pulled out his phone and made a call. Dr. Marshall was in a meeting, but called back 5 minutes later.
Yes, Amos, you're correct, he said. The Wyatts did move, but we kept in touch for about 7 years after, and they sent me their new address so I could write to them from time to time.
You didn't mention that when we questioned you.
I know, I'm sorry, but I take patient confidentiality very seriously. I tried to be as helpful as I could while still respecting
that professional duty.
You said they never visited her at the Institute. I assume that meant they weren't interested in her care. In fact, you said you believed them to be ignorant people in regard to Belinda's condition.
That's right.
How did you come by that opinion? And how did she even come to be at the Institute if her parents didn't care what had happened to her?
I don't think they initiated it.
Who did then?
I'm not sure. It might have been one of the doctors there who made the referral after it became clearer that her cognitive condition might be one that we should look into at the Institute.
Even 20 years ago, we had a national reputation, he added proudly. And we had enough funding to have paid for all of her expenses.
Okay, but if the Wyatts had no involvement in sending her to you, why would they correspond with you?
Decker thought he knew the answer, but he wanted to hear it from Marshall.
Well, because they were scared, Amos. They were scared of Belinda. At least that's what they told me. When she came back home to Utah, she was a very different person to them. And I don't mean for the better. Our work with her at the Institute apparently did not help her, and she left home soon thereafter. But they would apparently get messages from her, pretty frightening ones, and so they were scared.
That she would, what, hurt them?
I don't like to speculate about that.
Well, just give me your educated guess.
He could hear Marshall let out a long breath.
All right. I think they were terrified that she was going to murder them.
Well, they were spot on about that, thought Decker.
Can I have their old address, the one in Utah?
Do you have it?
Marshall gave it to him from the file.
Decker thanked him and clicked off.
He got on the computer and did a satellite search of the old address. He spun the laptop around so that Lancaster and Jameson could see.
Okay, ordinary house in an ordinary neighborhood,
Lancaster said.
Looks like mine.
And like mine, said Decker. But the point is, the Wyatts' new house was 5 times the size, with a pool and a separate 4-car garage filled with luxury vehicles. Lancaster's brows knitted together.
What did the Wyatts do for a living?
The info Bogart dug up says he was an assistant manager at the DMV. Mrs. Wyatt worked as a waitress in a diner.
Jameson said,
they were definitely not pulling down big bucks, so how did they afford a house like that?
Well, you follow the money to answer that.
Decker got on his phone again. He asked Bogart this question.
When he clicked off, he looked at Lancaster. He's going to check and get back to us.
What do you think is going on, Amos?
Asked Lancaster. I think we're getting close to finding out the motive behind all this, Mary. And once we do, it will all start to make sense.
Good, because up to this point, nothing has made sense. Nothing.
No. It always made sense to Wyatt and Leopold. It only doesn't make sense to us because we don't know enough.
How can killing so many people ever make sense?
It doesn't have to make sense to us, just to the ones who did it.
I hate the world,
said Lancaster, looking miserable.
I don't hate the world, said Decker. I only hate some of the people who unfortunately live in it.
Chapter 57. They later grabbed dinner at a fast food restaurant and brought it back with them to the library. After Decker finished eating, he left Lancaster and Jameson and entered the cafeteria. From there, he went through the door leading down into the tunnel and walked down the hall using a flashlight to illuminate the way. They had been over and over this ground and the adjacent army base, but had found no new clues. The army had gotten back to them with some information about the base and the tunnel connecting to the school, but it had shed no new light on the case. Decker emerged on the other side and walked up into the bowels of the military facility. He sat in an old oil drum and let his mind wander back over past events. Belinda Wyatt had been gang-raped, beaten, and left for dead. The motive was probably that her attackers had found out about her intersex condition.
The trauma had changed her brain, turning her into what Decker also was. I wonder if she remembers the rape and beating, or if she's forgotten it, like I did the hit on me. I wonder if she can never forget all the things she wants to forget. He did not like feeling any sort of connection to someone who had ended the lives of so many innocent people, but part of him could not help it. They were bound by their conditions. They were connected by their histories, their paths crossing at a traumatic point in their lives. Decker and Belinda had been at the Institute together. Something he had done there had caused her to target him. At some point, Belinda had become Billy. Billy had met up with Sebastian Leopold, an Austrian whose family had been killed and no one had been punished for the crime. Where had their paths crossed? A lot could happen in 20 years. Was it before or after she'd made the change to Billy? Had their meeting precipitated all the killings? And what the hell did I do to Wyatt to deserve all this misery? I thought I might find you here. Decker glanced over to see Bogart standing at the top of the steps leading from the tunnel. He held up a file. Information on the Wyatt's finances and Sebastian Leopold's family. They walked back to the library together, and Bogart, Decker, Jameson, and Lancaster started to go over the files. 20 minutes later, Lancaster held up a paper.
The Wyatts sold their house in Utah for $40,000 about 19 years ago. The new one they built at a cost of nearly $2 million, and it came with 20 acres.
And the source of the wealth? Asked Decker.
We couldn't find one, said Bogart.
How about a payoff? Said Decker. Lancaster shot him a glance.
A payoff? You mean blackmail?
It would explain the absence of a police report on Belinda's rape. It would explain where the cash came from to buy the house, far away in Colorado. Bogart added, and it might explain Belinda's outrage, that her parents could be bribed to not press the case.
Abuse and abandonment? Said Decker, eyeing him.
Bogart nodded.
Hence the mutilation and the murders of her parents.
Decker looked at the paper again. With her parents dead, I wonder what happened to whatever money was in their accounts.
But if people didn't know they were dead,
said Jameson. These days money is accessible by computer. You just have to have logins and passwords, said Decker, which I'm sure Belinda or Billy could get.
He would need something to live on, to fund travel, opined Bogart.
He might need it for something else, said Decker.
What?
Asked Bogart and Lancaster together. Decker stood. We need to go to where the Wyatts lived when she was raped, and we need to find out who raped her and how they got away with it. And we have to determine who paid all that money to the Wyatts.
It's a 20-year-old case, Decker, protested Bogart.
There's another reason to go, an even more important one.
What is it? Asked Bogart.
Worth a ride in your private jet, for sure. Chapter 58. They landed near a small town in northern Utah.
Mercy, Utah,
said Lancaster, as they deplaned into heavy snow and saw the sign on a plane hangar.
Okay, that's the height of irony,
commented Jameson. Bogart shivered and pulled his parka closer around him. So what was the reason worth a tank of jet fuel? He asked Decker. Decker eyed the three SUVs sitting on the tarmac, engines running, and heaters, he hoped, turned on full blast.
I'll show you.
They drove to the address of Belinda Wyatt's former home. It was in a small community of post-World War II housing, each house nearly a carbon copy of its neighbor. The streets were frozen slush. The house was dark. No cars were in the driveway. Decker sat in the back seat of the second SUV with Lancaster and Jameson next to him. Bogart was in front. Decker looked out the window and said, "So it was recently sold?" Bogart nodded.
20 months ago. Purchaser was a company.
Around 4 months before my family was killed, they need a place to stay and plan it all out.
You really think Wyatt bought her old house back?
Said Lancaster.
And with it, all those terrible memories?
This was her home, not the behemoth where she killed her parents and wrapped them in plastic. Despite what happened to her, she might see it as a place of solace, of safety, and she probably used some of the bribe money to buy it. I'm sure she would have thought it fitting to use their blood money to buy back what they so desperately wanted to sell. Jameson shot him a glance.
And what do you think we'll find inside?
Answers, said Decker. I hope. They went in through the front and rear, while other agents manned the perimeter, to make sure no one inside could possibly escape. They cleared each of the rooms, and then settled in the basement. Damn! Exclaimed Bogart, gazing around. I guess I expected to see walls covered in index cards with strings attached, running to other cards, like a manual version of an air traffic control system. But there was nothing like that down here. In fact, there was nothing but what one would expect to see in a basement. Junk. I was hoping for the same thing, said Decker. He looked all around, taking everything in, and started nodding as though the answer had occurred to him. Ironically, I overlooked one obvious but significant point. Wyatt has hyperthymesia. She doesn't need a wall of index cards. It's all in her head, every detail. And we don't know what Leopold is yet, except strange and a hell of an actor. He plays a clueless idiot better than anyone I've ever seen. But there's something else about him that I can't pinpoint. Bogart said, You told us he was inexplicable. He is inexplicable. Everyone has an agenda, whether altruistic or self-serving. So he has one, too. I just don't know what it is yet. Bogart said, Should we call in the locals? Decker shook his head. No. Why not? They get ticked when we don't at least inform them of what we're doing. Because it could be that the locals are the reason behind this whole thing. So we're going to process what little there is down here. He started poking around a plastic shelf with a few boxes of junk on them. Jameson started going through stuff in another corner. Lancaster and Bogart exchanged a glance and then did likewise. 2 hours later, Bogart said, Okay, there is nothing here, nothing.
No, there is,
said Jameson. She held up a newspaper clipping.
Where'd you get that?
Asked Lancaster.
It was stuffed in a box and under the table over there, with rags on top.
So what? Said Bogart. It's junk, just like everything else here.
No, when people save newspapers, they always save a stack of them. This was the only newspaper in this entire room. To a mind like Wyatt's, I bet it was a particle of disorder. Which made me wonder why it was here. There had to be a reason.
Decker studied her curiously. That's a good deduction, Jameson.
Hey, I might not be a hyper-what's-this, but I have my moments, and I can smell newsprint from a mile away. What does it say?
Asked Lancaster. She held up the front page of the newspaper and pointed to the large headline. Lancaster read,
Giles Evers gone missing.
Who the hell is Giles Evers? Said Bogart. Jameson said,
He was a police officer. The news story also said he was the son of Mercy's most prominent citizen, Clyde Evers, former mayor. Made a lot of money in mining, gave a lot of it to his hometown. Typical big fish in a small pond.
Why would Wyatt keep that clipping? Asked Bogart. Decker answered, Because Giles Evers raped her, and she made him disappear.
Whoa, that's a hell of a leap of logic, Amos,
said Lancaster. No, it's not. It would be the only reason this article would be here.
When was the article from?
Asked Lancaster. Jameson said,
19 months ago, right about the time the house was sold to the company we think Wyatt is behind.
Bogart and Lancaster stared at Decker. Okay, you're saying she was attacked by a police officer? Said Bogart, in a skeptical tone. By police officers, said Decker. It was a gang rape. And they did it because of her intersex condition, and Evers's old man paid off the Wyatts to keep it hush-hush. He got his son in the clear and saved the police department a ton of embarrassment and the rolling of heads. I can't imagine the Mercy Police Department is all that big. It might be that all the street cops were part of the rape. Hell of a hit for the men in blue to take. And the town. A town that maybe had no sympathy for someone like Belinda Wyatt.
But we can't be sure of that,
said Lancaster.
You're just speculating.
We can confirm it, said Decker. Let's go talk to some folks who were around back then. Chapter 59. The police chief from 2 decades ago had died 6 years before of a heart attack. There were 2 officers from that time who were still with the department. Neither of them knew anything about the Wyatt case. They had told Bogart when he and the others showed up at the single police station in town. The group was rapidly shown the door. As they drove away, Lancaster said,
They're lying. I could see it in their faces.
Small town, small enough that everyone knows everyone else's business, said Decker. I say we go to the top of the list.
You mean Giles Evers's father?
Said Jameson.
Clyde Evers?
If he's still alive. Bogart was looking at his smartphone, on which he had been doing a search.
Apparently he is, and it looks like he still lives here.
The address they drove to turned out to be a small house on the edge of town. As they pulled up, they could see lights on in the front windows. A porch ran along the front of the plank-sided house. Smoke curled upward from a chimney stack. The snow had started to fall once more. The house was run down, the lawn was lumpy, the trees and bushes diseased and mangled, and the single car in the driveway was an ancient Ford truck. Lancaster muttered,
The town's patriarch, huh? Must have fallen on hard times.
There might be a good reason for that, said Decker. At their knock, the front door opened and an old man, bloated and bent, stood there. His white beard reached to his chest, and his frayed pants were held up by knotted rope suspenders. Bogart identified himself, flashed his badge, and said they needed to speak to him about his son. Evers nodded dumbly and led the 4 of them into a tiny room where a fire crackled in a soot-smeared, stone-faced fireplace. The inside of the house was dark and smelled both of mildew and mothballs, and of whatever meal the man had microwaved that night. Decker's gaze shot everywhere before coming to rest on the old man, who fell back into a recliner, his shoeless feet off the floor. He scratched his cheek and looked at each of them in turn before his gaze returned to Decker.
You don't look like FBI.
That's because I'm not.
Uh-huh,
Evers said absently, as his gaze settled onto the fire.
So, you're here to find my boy? He said to the flames. Didn't think they'd get the Federals involved. But so be it. All I got left is that boy. Not much, but that's it.
You sacrificed a lot for him, didn't you? Said Decker. He looked around again. Pretty much everything, right? Evers shot him a glance before looking back at the fire.
What the hell do you know about anything?
So you don't know where he is, said Decker. Evers turned a fierce gaze on him.
What are you saying? That I took my own damn son? Are you simple or what?
I'm saying that Belinda Wyatt took him. But you already knew that. For a moment, Evers looked like he might collapse to the floor, but then he regained his composure and even flung his flabby hand out dismissively.
Belinda Wyatt! Ghost of the past, bullshit. What's she got to do with anything?
Decker said, She has to do with everything. She took Giles, and if we do find him, it'll just be his body. There could be no doubt of that. Something you also know, Mr. Evers. Your son is dead. Bogart, Jameson, and Lancaster all stared in alarm at Decker because of this provocative statement. But Decker never took his gaze off Evers. The old man's lips trembled and his breathing accelerated. He reached to a side table, picked up a cigarette and lighter, and ignited his smoke. He put it to his lips and inhaled. The nicotine seemed to calm him.
"You got his damn body?" he asked, blowing smoke out of his nostrils. "Is that why you're really here?"
"I doubt we'll find it, unless she wants us to." Evers exploded.
"Then why don't you go arrest that queer-ass bitch?"
Decker said, "That's why we're here. To get your help so we can do that." Evers sat up straighter.
"Why my help? I don't know anything. It's been over 20 years.
Decker continued. "And we came to you because your son and the other police officers who raped and nearly beat her to death apparently aren't around anymore. But you are." Evers sat up straighter.
"Nothing was ever proved. Hell, no case was ever even brought. My boy, not a mark on him. God's honest truth."
"Because you paid off the Wyatts and worked with the police chief back then to cover up the whole thing, including not filing a police report. They left her for dead, but she didn't die. She identified each one of them. Mercy may be extraordinarily misnamed, but it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody else. She knew who her assailants were. You're a prominent citizen here. She would have known your son. She would know he was with the police, but she was only 16. She would have believed that the police would protect her even from other cops. She was probably always told that if you have a problem or feel threatened in any way, go to the police." He paused. "Because they'll help you." He paused again, keeping his gaze steady on the old man. "Well, they didn't help her. They raped her, nearly killed her, and then covered it up."
"No proof,"
Bogart said. "We'll trace the money that was paid to the Wyatts by you, Mr. Evers." "And we talked to the Wyatts," Decker added, drawing a quick glance from Bogart and Jameson. "They told us what you did, so you can stop with the denials. We're on a tight time frame. I'm actually surprised you're still alive. I would have thought they would have taken you at the same time they took your son." The matter-of-fact tone employed by Decker seemed to deflate all the remaining fight in the old man. He jerked forward in the recliner so his feet touched the floor. He pointed a stubby, nicotine-stained finger at Decker.
"Damn statute of limitations has run on all this."
"It probably has," conceded Decker. "So you can tell us everything without fear that you will go to prison for any of it, no matter how much you should go to prison for what you did. But murder has no statute of limitations, so we can still find and punish Wyatt. You can help us do that." Evers stubbed out his cigarette and seemed to gather his thoughts for a few moments.
"I think what you got to understand is that the girl was weird. Asking for it, yes, sir."
"Asking to be gang-raped and nearly beaten to death?"
said Jameson, her mouth curved in disgust.
"What woman would ask for that?"
"Well, not that, of course. But those boys got carried away, is all. Boys being boys. Hell, you know."
"No, I really don't,"
said Lancaster, with even more disgust in her voice than Jameson's.
"And the boys would include your son?" interjected Bogart.
Evers nodded curtly.
"He was always in trouble. Got him to join the police force. Chief was a long-time buddy of mine. Owed me. Hell, the whole town owed me. Thought they would get him straight. Swear to God I did. Shows how wrong I was. Just gave him a gun and a chip on his shoulder and an attitude that what he wanted he just took." "How did his attention get drawn to Wyatt?" asked Bogart. "Well, see, there was talk over at the school about her. Like I said, weird shit. Never acted normal. Hell, like I said, she was queer-like, disgusting crap. My boy's a red-blooded American man. He wasn't gonna brook none of that vileness. It's a sin!
Actually, it's not,
said Lancaster.
But keep going.
Evers lit another cigarette and puffed as he talked.
Well, he and some others decided to go teach her a lesson.
How did they do that? Asked Decker. Evers pointed a finger at Decker.
You don't have it exactly right. It wasn't a bunch of police officers, just my boy. He was the only cop.
I don't understand, said Decker, looking taken aback. Belinda was gang-raped.
She was, but my boy was the only one in uniform.
Who were the others?
Asked Lancaster.
Oh, just some punks from the high school football team, and
Decker interrupted.
And the coach?
Lancaster hurriedly added.
And the assistant principal?
Evers looked amazed.
That's right. How do you know that?
Lancaster looked at Decker.
Amos, that's how she chose her targets at Mansfield. That's how she chose the location.
Decker said, how many football players were involved?
Evers shrugged. I don't know. 4, 5?
Try 6.
Hell, man! Come on! How do you know that? Said Evers. Even I can't remember. And I was here!
Belinda Wyatt told us.
But you said, just keep going.
Where did the rape take place?
In the cafeteria, my son told me. Don't know why they picked that place, but that's where he said it happened. Did her up on a table, I believe.
He added nonchalantly. Bogart, Jameson, and Lancaster all exchanged glances.
How did your son get a hold of Belinda? Asked Decker. He picked her up in his patrol car when he saw her walking on the street one night. Apparently she walked at night a lot. He'd seen her before. He told her he was going to look after her.
What did he mean by that? Asked Bogart sharply.
Like I said, she was a freak, and folks here made a point of telling her so to her face. No, they were none too kind. Me, I say the Lord makes them in lots of different ways. What will be. But not some others round here. So her life was pretty bad in Mercy. Giles knew that. So we used that to sort of lure her in.
Why would he even care about her? Asked Decker.
Hey, he played football at the high school, went there with the coach, Howard Clark and Connor Wise, the assistant principal, when they were all younger, of course.
He lowered his voice.
And word at the school was that Wyatt was part man, part woman. Girls in gym class said she had balls. My God, can you believe that? I bet the Wyatts were into drugs and such. Maybe they were hippies. Get that in your body and have a kid, and shit like that happens. A girl with balls.
That is absolutely ridiculous, blurted out Bogart.
So you say. Don't make it true, countered Evers. Anyway, some fellers on the football team, they dated some of these girls. So they got wind of it. They told Howard and my son and Connor. They all got together and figured they'd teach her a little lesson.
By nearly killing her?
Snapped Lancaster.
Evers got a thoughtful look on his face.
You know what? I think they were maybe trying to help her. You know, let the girl feel what it was like to have a man doing things to her. Get her back to normal. Make her see she was really a gal and all, and how good it was to be with a man.
Bogart said, Don't try to spin this into something positive, Mr. Evers. The statute of limitations might have run out on the rape and assault. But if you try to obstruct justice, I'll have your ass in a prison cell faster than you can take another puff on that cigarette. Evers stared at him for a moment, and then hurried on with his story.
Well, I guess things got out of hand. She fought back real hard, so they had to, beat her up some. I guess one of them hit her so hard they thought they'd killed her. She was unconscious and bleeding and everything. And Giles told me she stopped breathing. So they got a little scared, and they threw her in the dumpster behind the school, and then they all took off. But she come to and dragged herself out of there. She went to the cops and reported it. Like I said, the chief was my old buddy, owed me for things in the past, called me. Her parents knew, of course. She told them. I scraped every dime I could get my hands on to keep it quiet.
His face turned into a mask of fury.
The Wyatts sucked me dry, the bastards.
Is that the way you saw it? Asked Bogart. A negotiation?
It's the way they saw it. Look around. I live in this shit pile now. Wife long dead. It killed her. She knew. Killed her dead. Took every penny I got. Sold every property I had. All my assets gone. The damn Wyatts probably built some mansion somewhere. Hell, I don't know. And they were the ones brought that freak into this world. And I live here after busting my hump for 60 years. This is all I got to show for it.
He looked around.
My fridge is 20 years old. Haven't had a new car in forever. One out there don't even run.
Well, I'm sure it's been painful for you, said Bogart dryly.
Decker said, but why do anything? Why pay any money? It was they said, she said. The whole town was against her. The cops could have gotten rid of the evidence, protecting their own. And the chief was your buddy. The Wyatts suckered you.
Evers puffed on his cigarette and shook his head resignedly.
No, sir, they weren't bluffing. They had evidence.
How?
Asked Bogart.
Before Belinda Wyatt went home, she walked herself on over to the damn hospital, and they did a rape and assault kit. No question she had been raped and beat up bad. Had my boy's evidence on it, and everybody else's. DNA, blood, and skin under her fingernails. All that shit. Dead to rights. Then, like I said, Belinda told her parents what happened.
But they didn't call the cops, said Decker.
No, they knew the lay of the land and mercy. The Everses were at the top. Everybody else, not so much. No one here would have given a damn, but the Wyatts played it smart. Had to hand it to them. They threatened to turn everything over to the state police, the FBI even. Well, I had to do something.
He finished his cigarette and stared over at Decker.
Couldn't let my only son go down over messing up some piece of trash.
Decker said, I thought you were of the mind to live and let live. The Lord makes them in lots of different ways. What will be, will be. Evers looked at him cagily.
Yeah, well, the Lord wasn't going to get my boy off a rape charge if we let it get outside of mercy, was he?
What were the circumstances of your son's disappearance? Asked Decker.
Pretty damn simple. Went out drinking one night and never came back.
Is he married? Have any kids?
Divorced. Wife's gone and took the kids. Got his ass kicked off the police force. He lived here with me.
Well, that's some justice, thought Decker.
Why all this interest now?
Evers wanted to know. Have you received anything that seemed off, weird, inexplicable? Asked Decker, ignoring the old man's question. Evers thought for a moment.
Well, there's that one thing.
What thing? Said Decker quickly.
Hell, I'll go fetch it.
The old man struggled up and was gone for a minute. Bogart looked at Decker. Well, this explains why Wyatt is doing what she's doing. Revenge. She picked Mansfield because of what happened to her at the high school here. Lancaster added,
And she picked her victims the same way, mirrored the people who nearly killed her, 6 football players, the coach and the assistant principal.
Jameson looked at Decker.
But it still doesn't explain why she came after you.
Decker stared back at her. No, it doesn't. Evers returned with a single piece of paper.
Somebody slipped this under my door a few months back. Never could make heads nor tails of it.
He handed it to Decker. The others gathered around to look at it. It was a printout of a web page. Its title was Justice Denied. Underneath was a list of names, and next to each was a crime. Murder, rape, assault, kidnapping. At the bottom of the page there was a declaration. Each of these crimes was committed by a man in a police uniform, and every single one was covered up. But we will not forget. Justice will not be denied. Decker quickly read down the list of names until he came to one that made him stop. We just found out how Belinda Wyatt and Leopold hooked up. All three of them stared at the names. Caroline and Deidre Leopold. Next to their names was the crime committed against them. Murder.
Chapter 60. During the flight back to Burlington, they all read over the case notes of the Leopold's murders in a village 20 kilometers from Vienna. At the request of the FBI, the Austrian police had also sent along information on Leopold's background.
There is nothing in here about cops possibly killing Leopold's family,
said Lancaster.
Well, if it was true, I doubt they'd put that in the file, said Bogart.
Decker, who had been reading over the autopsy reports on the two victims, looked up at Bogart. You have any string on this, Jet?
String? Or rope?
They found some rope in an emergency kit stowed in a storage bin, and Bogart watched as Decker took lengths of rope and started forming knots out of them.
What's that? Asked Bogart.
It might be something or it might not, was all Decker would say. Later he read down the justice denied paper that someone had left at Clyde Everett's door. Then he looked at the knots he had formed with the rope and then at the page. He read over the Leopold murder file, again absorbing every bit of information. Finished, he closed his eyes and began putting the pieces together. His eyes were still closed when the jet touched down.
Amos, time to go,
said Lancaster. As they drove away in the SUV, Bogart said,
My people will trace this website and see what we can find out.
Lancaster nodded and then glanced at Decker, who was staring out the window.
What do you think, Amos?
He was sitting in his seat, still holding the knotted lengths of rope.
I'm thinking that a lot of people are dead because of a bunch of ignorant folks. Wyatt and Leopold made choices. Bad ones, said Bogart. Horrible ones. They're responsible for this and no one else.
And human beings have limits, said Decker. And you can say all you want about the world being unfair and people rising above the atrocities done to them, but everyone is different. Some are hard as steel, some are fragile, and you never know which one you're going to get.
They killed your family, Decker, barked Bogart.
Lancaster and Jameson exchanged nervous glances. Decker didn't look at the FBI agent, which is why we're going to catch them. And their lives will end either in prison or in a death chamber. But don't expect me to fully blame Wyatt for this, because I can't, and I won't.
I wonder where Giles Evers is,
said Jameson.
In hell, I hope, replied Decker.
Decker asked to be dropped off at the Residence Inn. He walked up the steps to the second floor, and gazed back as the SUV rolled out of the parking lot. Jameson was staring out the window at him. She gave him a tiny wave. He didn't return it. He went into his room and sat on the bed, the springs sagging under his girth. He closed his eyes and let his mind whir back to two images of the same person but in different situations and garb. Billy, the waitress at the bar. Billy, the mop boy at the 7-Eleven. He had gotten a good look at Billy the mop boy's face, not so with Billy the waitress. He scrunched his eyes tighter as though refocusing a camera. The chin was the same on both, the line of the jaw and the hands. People always forgot about the hands, but they could be as distinctive as a fingerprint if you knew what to look for. Long, delicate fingers, short right pinky, no nail polish on the waitress, split nail on the left index, small wart on the right thumb. Same person? Absolutely. He opened his eyes wide in surprise. He had just seen Billy, in color,
for the first time. Gray. For him, as for many folks, it was a confusing color. It lent itself to no particular interpretation. It was a color that could go one way or the other. People desperately wanted the world to be clear-cut and black and white. It made life so much easier. Tough decisions faded away, everything was nicely organized and cataloged, and so were people. But the world was not like that. And neither were the people who inhabited it. At least for those who bothered to explore its complexity, its grayness. Now, for him, Leopold was yellow. Yellow was not ambivalent. Yellow was hostile, cunning. Sometimes colors were spot on, as clear-cut as numbers, actually. The pieces were falling into place. But why target me? What the hell did I ever do to you, Belinda, Billy, what? Their only contact had been at the Institute 20 years ago. His family had been killed more than 16 months ago. Quite a gap. Why the wait? Because she had run into Sebastian Leopold during that time? And he had given her a way to get back at Decker? Avenge herself? But for what? The Institute, ground zero for them both, interaction limited, words spoken directly to each other? Exactly none. He closed his eyes again. He had to get this right. He had to be thorough. Wyatt had a reason for everything. She had been amazingly meticulous. The symmetry was spellbinding in its depravity, in its horror, so there had to be a reason for this, too. His DVR whirred back and forth. Images flashed past with astonishing speed, but he missed nothing. He saw everything that was there as though it was happening to him right then and at normal speed. No, in slow motion. Every word, every moment, everything moving at the pace of a snail. In the group sessions, he had spoken of his future, his hopes and dreams, but so had everyone else. Well, everyone except Belinda. She had been given the opportunity, but had not volunteered any information about her future plans. She apparently didn't have any future plans, at least not then. Well, that changed. Some knew of Decker's past, of his trauma, his near death on the playing field. He had not known of Belinda's plight, though perhaps she didn't know that. She might have thought that if she knew about him, he knew about her. But what did that matter, really? He opened his eyes, his brow creasing with the failure of his mind. His extraordinary brain-traumatized, bastardized mind that had been born to him after his death and resurrection to solve the one conundrum that would make all the other pieces fall into place. He left because he could not stay here. 30 minutes later, he walked into the Burlington police station. Captain Miller was there. Bogart had already briefed him on the trip to Utah. Miller informed him.
"You don't look so good, Amos," Miller said. "Should I?" Decker said back. Miller tapped his head. "It's not coming?"
"It's there. I just can't make it tell me what I need to know." "You have an exceptional mind, but it's still a lot to figure out."
"Well, someone has to. And if it's not me, it has to be someone else." "You think they might pull up their tent and leave?"
"Not yet."
"What are they waiting for?" asked Miller.
"Me."
He went down to the evidence locker and filled out the necessary paperwork with Miller's authorization to step inside the locker and look through the evidence gathered thus far. Since he was no longer with the police, someone had to accompany him. That person was Sally Brimmer, who explained,
"It's not like I have a higher priority than this case, Decker."
They sat at a table as Decker went over every evidence bag, many of them twice. He finally came to his uniform the second time around.
"Technically, you should have turned in your badge,"
admonished Brimmer.
"It's no good anymore anyway, the way they defaced it."
Decker picked up the bag and looked through the plastic at the badge with the X cut through it. "X-ing me out," he thought, "like you did with Giles Evers. He was wearing a uniform when he took you under false pretenses, Belinda." In a sense, they were all in uniform.
The cop, the football players, the coach, even the assistant principal, cloaked in the authority of the school. You were surrounded by people who should have protected you, but they didn't. Instead, they destroyed you, starting with a cop, with a badge, just like mine. He rubbed the metal through the plastic. Then he stopped. It was like rubbing a genie's lamp. He made a silly little wish, never thinking it would come true. But it just had. The last piece had just fallen into place, and Amos Decker finally understood what he had done to deserve all this. Chapter 61. He walked into the library at Mansfield High with a certain knowledge that he had to do this. There were about a half dozen people working here, but Lancaster, Jameson, and Bogart were not among them. It was late. Perhaps they were catching some sleep. His phone buzzed. Surprisingly, it was Bogart. He had some information on the Justice Denied matter. And he also told Decker that the Wyatts had nearly $10 million in liquid assets, but that monies had been funneled out of the accounts at the rate of $1 million per month for the last 9 months. Decker listened to it all. Bogart said, "What do you make of that?" "That it all makes sense."
"What the hell does that mean?"
"Exactly what I said."
"Where are you?"
"In my room, getting ready to go to sleep."
"I'll check back in the morning," said Bogart.
"Right," said Decker.
He sat down at one of the laptops and logged in using the password he had previously been given. He went to the Justice Denied website. There was a program there to set up personal messaging accounts so that people could correspond privately with the organizers of the site. He set up a username and password, filled out a form, and made a request. They had to monitor it, he thought. There was no way they could not. That might be why they had left the information about the site with Clyde Evers, just in case Decker made the connection and went to visit the old man. This was all a puzzle, and every piece fit in somewhere. 30 minutes went by, then an hour, then 2 hours. Decker just sat there, the color gray chief in his mind. Though he'd lived with this new mind for 20 years now, it still felt like he was existing in someone else's body, and that any minute, or after an odd synaptic fire, he would be back to his old self and his quite ordinary brain. His phone buzzed again. It was Jameson. He didn't answer it. At the 3-hour mark, the message popped up in his new account. "You finally got there, bro. Congratulations." Decker also knew what the bro reference was to now. It was simple, really. They were all brothers, weren't they? All lumped together by Wyatt, by Leopold. It was unfair, of course. It was unjust. But still, he could understand it. He typed in a request and sent it off, and waited. Finally, the response came. "Why should we?" He had not expected them to simply agree to what he had proposed. He typed in his answer. He hoped it was good enough. He doubted he would get another chance like this. "This needs to end sometime. Why not now? I'm the only one left." Unless he was missing something really big, he was the only one left. And he didn't think he was missing anything, not anymore. In fact, he might have discovered something that everyone else had missed, and he meant everyone, the two people on the other end of this digital line included. They would suspect a trap, of course. They couldn't even know it was him. He was expecting a test, and it came with the next missive. The number of Dwayne LaCroix's jersey. They had definitely done their homework, or maybe Wyatt had heard something about him at the Institute and dug that up. The query said he had 5 seconds to answer. No looking up anything online. Google or YouTube was not going to be an option here, but he didn't need it. Even without his special talent, he would forevermore remember those two digits, even if he hadn't seen them before the hit occurred. He instantly typed the answer and sent it off. 24. The response was immediate. Instructions to follow in 5 minutes. Stand by. He waited, his internal clock ticking away in his head. When 360 seconds had passed, it came. He studied it. It was smart, calculated. They were taking no chances. It was like traveling by stagecoach, with way stations along the journey, allowing them ample opportunity to see if Decker was truly alone. He would get to one station, and there would be a communication telling him where to go next. They had obviously planned this out previously, as though they knew exactly how all this was going to play out. And that, Decker had to concede, was more than a little unnerving. He rose and left. He was back at his room in 30 minutes. It took him all of 3 minutes to pack up pretty much all he had. It fit into a bag 2 feet square, with room to spare. As he hit the doorway, he looked back. His home. The only one he had now. A rental, one room. Not really much of a home, so he felt absolutely nothing at leaving it. If this turned out badly for him, he would miss Lancaster, Miller, and Jameson, and maybe even Agent Bogart. But that was about it. He closed the door and dropped the key off in the office slot. He knew he would not be coming back. That was just the way it had to be. For a lot of reasons. Chapter 62. The bus took him to Crewe, 3 towns over from Burlington. The snow was picking up, and the lights on the interstate illuminated a fat, wet precipitation that would add tonnage to this part of the country until it finally stopped falling. And then the highway department would spend days cleaning it up, only to see Mother Nature do it all over again. He looked out the window of the bus, his phone in his hand. They hadn't told him how the next communication would come, but he wanted to be ready. He alighted at Crewe, along with only 3 others. Their possessions were nearly as meager as his, although one woman had a full suitcase and a pillow and a small, sleepy child in tow. He looked up and down the snowy underhang of the bus station platform. There were few people out and about, and all of them, clearly, of limited resources. A man approached him. He was black, in his 60s, with a big belly, snow-caked boots, and a coat with rips down both sides. A flapped hat hung low over his head. His glasses were fogged. He stopped in front of Decker and said,
"Amos?"
Decker looked at him and nodded. "Who are you?"
"I'm nobody. But somebody gave me $100 to give you this, and so I am."
He handed Decker a slip of paper. "Who was it?"
"Didn't see him."
"How'd you know to look for me?"
"They said a really tall, fat, scary-looking white dude with a beard. You it."
The man lumbered off, and Decker looked down at the instructions on the note. He went in and bought another bus ticket. He had 2 hours to kill. He bought a coffee from the machine in the station. It was more warm than hot, but he didn't care. He spent his time looking at everyone in the waiting room. It was more crowded than he would have thought. Then he realized something. Thanksgiving was nearly here. These folks were probably heading out to see family and carve up a big turkey. He and Cassie had never celebrated Thanksgiving together, chiefly because one or the other had always been working the holiday shift. Decker had spent more than one turkey day chowing down at a diner or a fast food place. Cassie had spent her share in the hospital dining hall. Whoever had Molly in a given year would eat out. They had enjoyed it and had never felt like they were missing much. But looking around at these folks, Decker concluded that he had missed more than he had thought. The next bus dropped him off at the Indiana border. There was a compact car waiting in the station parking lot, its engine running. The note had said to walk toward it and tap on the driver's window. He knew this was also a test. He went to the car and rapped on the window. The woman inside rolled down the window and said,
"Get in the back."
He did so. If the FBI had been tailing him, now would be the time to surround the vehicle. They didn't. because they weren't tailing him. He got in the back. The car was small, so his knees were wedged behind the seat. "You know my friends?" he asked.
"I don't have friends,"
she replied. Her hair was stringy and gray. Her body odor strong and unpleasant, especially in the hot car. She had the heater on max, and her craggy voice and the hazy cigarette smoke that hung in the air foretold a painful death from lung cancer. "That's too bad," he said.
"Not from where I'm sitting."
"How much did they pay you to do this?"
"Enough."
"You meet them?"
"Nope."
"You know what this is about?"
"This is about $600 to yours truly. That's all I need to know."
She put the stick in gear and they sped off. They drove for so long that Decker found himself dozing off. That was remarkable when he woke and thought about it, since he was traveling to his death. Or, more accurately, my murder. They crossed over Interstate 74, reached nearly to Seymour, and then got onto Interstate 65, heading north toward Indianapolis. But they exited well before then. They sped west, passing Nashville, Indiana. Decker saw a sign for Bloomington to the south, but they didn't take it. He was thinking they might be driving all the way to Terre Haute, near the Illinois border, when the woman pulled off onto the shoulder at an exit a few miles before Interstate 70, running east to west, could be picked up. She said,